But first today to an issue we covered at the start of its life, and we've waited to see the turn of events before returning to it, namely the UK referendum about whether to remain in the EU or leave. That's due in a month's time, June the 23rd, and we're now into the final furlong of this substantial race to influence British public opinion. My first guest this hour is right in the thick of it and has been outlining his insights here during a range of lectures, considering what the future might look like outside the EU, especially at a time when global growth, as we discussed last week, is looking rather brittle. Dr. Robin Niblett is the director of the London-based Chatham House, officially called the Royal Institute of International Affairs. It's ranked the world's most influential non-US think tank. The most influential, apparently, is seen as the Brookings Institution. Chatham House emerged from the 1919 Paris Peace Conference after World War I, with its mission to analyse and understand major international issues and current affairs. Quite some challenges facing it right now, I think you'd agree. Dr. Niblett has headed other international relations think tanks before taking the helm at Chatham House, and he was advisor to the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee last year. So, Robin Niblett, thank you very much for making time to join us and bring us up to date with how this debate about the UK and the world is unfolding.
Afternoon.
This is a debate that's becoming rather emotional, it seems, from this perspective anyway, almost extreme. The former London Mayor Boris Johnson, who's in the Leave camp, has caused quite a stir, saying both Hitler and Napoleon had failed at unification, and the EU was an attempt to do this by different methods. How is it the debate being shaped, do you judge? By emotions, nationalism, economics, politics?
Well, all of the above. I think what's happened in the last 3 to 4 weeks prior to this last month is that the economic argument for leaving has taken quite a few knocks, not least as the leading members of the Leave campaign, Michael Gove, the Justice Secretary, and Boris Johnson, have decided, and clearly this wasn't their initial decision, to say that they would not want the UK to remain in the EU's single market. And once you say that, and Michael Gove went on air to say that, you know, Britain could be fine, it would be like Albania or Ukraine on the outside. Once you start comparing Britain to Albania and Ukraine economically, you're in trouble. So I think there's been a shift away from that set of argumentation to some more emotive core. And Boris Johnson, either by instinct or by design, is hitting on some strong notes for those who will be swayed by emotion. Firstly, this idea that Europe is something separate from the UK, bringing Napoleon, Charlemagne was in the list as well, I think, at one point. Hitler may seem extreme, but this idea that Europe is this thing that's constantly being at conflict, at war, and that Britain is separate to it is an important subtext, you know, that we're not of Europe. We're something that's always observed Europe from the outside. As Winston Churchill said, he was all in favor of the United States of Europe. He just didn't want Britain to be part of it. But he's also tapping into this concept that Europe is something that's done to Britain rather than something that Britain is involved in. If you talk about the EU trying to centralize Europe, then it almost implies that Britain doesn't have a voice at the table, because, of course, Britain does. It's a very strong member of the EU, and nothing of the sort has happened yet, and probably is unlikely to either.
Yes, when I went to Ireland earlier this year, the Irish just couldn't believe that this was even a debate in Britain, because, you know, really the dramatic change was their absorption into the EU in 74, I think it was, and they felt it was little Britain at work, and that it was an own goal of the most monumental proportions.
Look, if you talk to people in the United States, the conversations I've had here in Australia, leaders of the Commonwealth, the part of the world that many Brexiteers, as they're called, keep harking to, say we could re-establish our close relationships with the growing, exciting Commonwealth. Of course, all the Commonwealth leaders are saying, please stay in, we need the British voice at the table, and we don't want to lose it. So this idea of scoring a monumental own goal, I think, is a powerful one. And this is where the economic argument is coming in most strongly. It is not as emotive. You know, it requires a certain amount of using facts and figures. And people can have facts and figures thrown at them from different directions. But the fact of the matter is, when the UK's economy is doing as well as it is right now, one of the fastest growing major economies in the EU, the largest attractor foreign direct investment in Europe for the last 10 years, year on year, low unemployment. It's got the lowest level, ironically, of regulation, as judged by the OECD, second only to the Netherlands. You'd ask yourself, well, what's the problem?
Well, can I read from Jacob Rees-Mogg, whose father was editor of The Times, of course, a very prominent man, and he wrote a piece recently suggesting that the EU is not now what it was first sold to be to the member countries. It was meant to be an alliance of nations, not a super nation, but over the years it has gained the symbols and powers of a state. And he goes on to talk about having a flag, an anthem, a parliament, several presidents, and all sorts of control of regulation. But it's a failed state. So all of this is bounded up together. Now, is that the sort of argument still being put by the people who want to go?
Yeah, no, I think the idea that the EU is going to become a super state is a regular argument you hear at the moment.
Well, he says it is right now.
Well, I think they've got to work out, is it a super state or is it a failed state? Because if it's a failed state, it can't be a super state. So the contradictions have never been a problem for Jacob Rees-Mogg when talking about the European Union. And this is what you get, is on the one hand, the EU is this super state that's you know, sucking Britain into its orbit. On the other hand, it's, as Daniel Hannan, the member of the European Parliament, who's a strong Eurosceptic, has said, that Britain has ended up shackled to a corpse of dying, aging, sclerotic Europe. So these images of Europe both as a failed project, but at the same time a project that in its unifying
it's like a behemoth
is going to somehow drag Britain down is a very, it's imagery that resonates extremely well in the UK with many people.
Well, in fact, can I just say, the argument that you say, you've just released this interesting paper, Britain, the EU and the sovereignty myth, your argument is that it is about questions of sovereignty at the very heart of it all, but that Britain is very much in control. So make that argument for us, please.
Well, the first point I'd make is having sovereign power is something you use as a government. And most governments, especially in an independent and global economy, choose to pool aspects of their sovereign power here and there, especially if you're a smaller country, to get what you want. My argument would be is, you know, keep as much power as you possibly can because it's legitimate, but you need to make the case that in some places you pool it. In the case of the EU, being part of a market of 500 million people rather than 65 million gives you bigger clout in international trade negotiations, means you can get access to a market of 500 million people without having to write new rules every 5 days. And British governments, Labour and Conservative, have concluded that pooling power over competition policy, product regulation, trade policy is in British national interest. That doesn't mean that Britain hasn't kept power over just about everything that matters to British citizens, like pensions, education, healthcare, defence, monetary policy. I could go on.
But not, for instance, he quotes fishery policy.
Yep.
The EU policy has been a little short of disastrous.
Well, you know, the statement disastrous depends which way you want to play disastrous. What the EU fisheries policy has tried to do is to stop overfishing in large areas of the shared waters. And, I mean, I think the fishing community is probably one of the communities that I think feels most sceptical about the EU, and it's probably going to be a rich seam of leaving votes for the simple fact that it's Brussels that's telling the fishermen how much quota they can have and can't have. My simple point would be if the UK was outside the EU, it would be London telling the fishermen what they couldn't, how much quota they could have and couldn't have.
Right.
You'd simply swap one lot for another. But then, you know, that's the case to be made.
So if it did pull back from the EU, you'd have to renegotiate all of these deals again, would you? Is that part of the argument, isn't it?
Look, I think even those who are arguing that Britain should leave have recognised that in the short term there'd be quite a shock to the British economy. First of all, if Britain is not going to remain a member of the single market like Norway is, then it's going to have to renegotiate literally every single element, from rewrite every law on competition policy, on car safety, on environmental regulation. You know, over the last 40 years, the UK has taken on board into its legal framework laws that it helped negotiate, and in most cases, it helped design in the EU. And would have to either just copy them out again and pass them out again in British law, or would have to adjust them if Parliament wanted to adjust them. Then it also has to renegotiate the 50 to 53 is over 50 trade agreements that it is a signatory to. Well, it isn't. It is that as a member of the EU, it has access to around the world.
How will the Conservative Party survive all this? I mean, it's divided on how to vote. David Cameron firmly in the Stay camp and Boris Johnson in the Leave camp. I mean, what will it mean for their political careers when the outcome's known?
It's become a civil war, principally within the Conservative Party, between the more internationalist, business-friendly wing and the more nativist, populist wing that is under threat, one might argue, from the UK Independence Party, which has taken quite a few votes from the Conservative Party. So there's some sort of domestic reasons to want to take this line. But it is a battle between those two sides. Look, if Britain votes to leave, David Cameron, I think, will resign. He said he won't, but I think it's almost certain that he would. Yeah, I think it would be the end of George Osborne as well, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And Boris Johnson would clearly be reinforced, not just because he chose to take this line and it was undecided to the last minute as to which way he would go, but also because he will have proved he can win a campaign. And that will raise his credibility a lot. I think
And what if he doesn't? Because I would have thought he'd done himself some damage this week, but I don't know whether you agree.
Look, we're in a, to use the phrase I use these days, we're in a Trumpy world. and in this world, success is success. And you can say radical things and then you pivot away from them later on. You say, well, I didn't really mean that. You know, what I meant was. But you stir up the emotions, you get people on your side, and then you kind of manipulate the outcome afterwards.
And look, just very quickly, you say even a very narrow Remain vote might damage Cameron.
Yes, I think so.
Really? Why?
Well, you've got to remember, he called the referendum. A lot of people are wondering why he called it in the first place. He didn't have to. There was no obligation to. There's no treaty out there. You've got to remember, the British government did, I think, quite an intelligent thing from a democratic legitimacy point. After he formed the coalition government in 2010, they passed a thing called the Sovereignty Act. And the Sovereignty Act means that if there is any new treaty in the European Union that devolves the slightest amount of sovereignty away from the British Parliament to EU processes, then it has to be approved by a popular referendum. So Britain already had that in 2011. He chose to call this referendum because I think he thought he could win it. He thought it would bolster his chances at the next election. It was not taken really with a view of the British national interest in mind, and that's why he's now arguing so desperately and rather late in the game how important it is for the UK to remain. So to make that kind of an error in judgment if Britain leaves, and it will be seen to be an error if Britain leaves. Of course, if Britain stays, he'll be the first Prime Minister to have won three referenda in his time as Prime Minister, which would be remarkable.
Dr. Niblett, thank you very much indeed for those insights.
My pleasure. Delighted to have done it, Geraldine.
And Robin Niblett is Director of Chatham House. He's been visiting Australia and giving a range of lectures. And I should just add that Jacob Rees-Mogg is the Tory member for North East Somerset. And that just to alert British listeners that Mena Rawlings, Mrs. Rawlings, the UK High Commissioner, has urged people who live here, 1.1 million Britons residing here, the biggest diaspora in the world, that it's possible to register online as an overseas voter, but you've got to register by the 7th of June if you want to vote in the upcoming referendum. So you better get your skates on if you've got some views, and you can let us know as well.